You can't do it in the Oval Office. And so they wheel him next door, almost like he's fucking... like he's a Citizen Kane. They wheel him next door. He's got the FDR blanket. You can almost... keeping him warm. And he sits there and he reads off the screen, and that's the president. Another fake messiah. It's all bullshit. It's all smoke and mirrors. Special effects, Hollywood. Distraction. Parlor tricks. That's what our so-called leaders are. And when the chips are down, you blame the other guy. Biden was blaming Trump this week at a McAuliffe rally, and Birx is saying that Trump killed people because they weren't wearing masks. Is that what happened? Really? Okay. Sure. That's just more proof that she had no fucking business being in that position. And that her and her buddies killed a lot more people than you can shake a stick at. The Joker and the thief, well, we're talking about both of them. Emails have come out. We're still talking about, previously this week, we talked about Afghanistan and what went down there. And emails have come out this week. Of course, there's still, I think, well over 1,000 people, 1,000 Americans stranded, being held hostage against their will in Afghanistan, but nobody seems to care about them in the White House, the Biden administration. Emails now have leaked. It's an email written by U.S. diplomat and revealed by Senator Josh Hawley, indicated there was no security vetting of the people allowed to board a United States military aircraft and evacuate Kabul as part of the Biden administration's hastily called non-combatant evacuation operation. Why would there be if you're trying to bring more terrorists in the United States, more mayhem, more disease? This is how the Joker and the thief behave. President Biden said, let them come over. We don't care who they are. Just put them on the fucking planes. Let's go. That's nice. Well, we knew that. We saw these planes were packed to the hill. These people barely had clothes on, let alone ID. Excuse me, sir. Do you have a valid passport? I mean, this is ridiculous. Huh? This is the worst airline ever. No, there won't be a beverage cart, you cretin. Don't worry if they're a known terrorist. Of course, wouldn't you have the FBI vet these people then when they step off a plane? No, they're too busy chasing down soccer moms and grandmoms who walked around a building on January 6th. They're busy.
We have a lot of... these guys look pretty shady, man. We have a lot of what looks to be like terrorists. This could be Al-Qaeda. I think the one guy is Al-Qaeda. I keep calling him out. I'm going to check these guys out. I want to get off the plane and have some people from the FBI there. Somebody. You know, anybody. Dog catcher, anybody. Anybody there? I repeat, Mayday. This place... The only thing we're missing here is some camels.
Yeah, these people have your best interest in mind. You paid the government for what? Protection and safety, and to protect you and your loved ones and your belongings, your property. Supposedly. You keep paying, though. Let me know how it works out. What do we got left? Rock and roll. We got a couple videos left. Couple videos. I'm looking at some other stories on pain.tv. A lot of this stuff is already broken today. We've talked about it previously. You're free to check those stories out. What are we going to do? Let's go to the... We got a 1-2, 1-2-3 punch. We got a nurse video, boom. We got the closing tunes, a little closing action. Pick out a nice song for you. I don't know what it's going to be yet. And then at the end, we go back to Capitol Hill. Very interesting exchange. Again, involving the Attorney General. Keep in mind what I said about these exchanges. While they are informative to a certain degree, they're scripted, just like everything else. Did you ever see the movie The Truman Show? It's worth watching. You just didn't know that you're Truman. Marie Albanese tomorrow. Take care. God bless. Thanks to the folks on pain.tv.
Jessica, what is it that you do for a living?
Sure. I'm a registered nurse and a nursing professor.
Okay. And what is work like for you right now with what we understand as the governor's COVID shot mandate coming down as of the end of next week?
Sure. So I'm not sure if you have time for it today. I have quite a bit of data for you from boots on the ground within about 15 facilities in Maine. For myself, I was actually one of the nurses that was terminated on September 30th from one of my two jobs. And that was as a result of the mandate. So I do know quite a bit of information still going on in that facility out of the 15 I have today. And I can certainly share that with you when you're ready.
Okay, well, we're always ready.
Yeah, we'll take notes.
Sure. Yeah, we'll take notes.
Sure.
There are a lot of things going on. A lot of information is coming in over the transom, really. And we're getting, I'm saying we, the reporters who do these things, we're hearing we're getting ready to roll out vaccines for younger children. We're hearing that there are outbreaks in Maine. We know about the legal aspects. Federal courts are not dealing with it. So what are the numbers that you're seeing in hospitals?
Okay. So it's up to you if you want me to kind of go through the facilities as I have them marked up, or if you want me to just do more of a general what the mandate's causing. I'm not going to lie, George. It's causing quite a hit on our already strained healthcare infrastructure. And one of the fights we have at the moment isn't just about vaccine choice. Governor Mills has one of the harshest mandate guidelines with no testing alternatives. We're trying to prevent a devastating crisis. If you don't mind, before I get into some details, certainly interrupt you at any time. It's your show. Mills stated that anyone who is placed in the care of a healthcare worker has the right to expect, as do their families, that they will receive high-quality, safe care from fully vaccinated staff. I can promise the public that based on what boots on the ground are reporting, that this mandate has far-reaching consequences, which include many across our state, not receiving the high-quality, safe care that Mills has promised they would get. Nurses and other healthcare workers can only deliver this excellent care if the circumstances they are working under afford them that option. And I can assure you, as a nurse, and from boots on the ground, that a nurse's vaccination status has nothing to do with the care he or she will deliver and how fast a firefighter puts out a fire. As I get into some of these details from what's going on inside the hospitals, I'll start with a few EMS departments. Wyndham EMS staff is down 25%. As you know, even when we're down one truck, the former employer I had was Reddington Fairview General Hospital, who had their own EMS service. When we're down even one truck, which is staffed by two individuals, that's quite a holdup for people. That's 911 ambulance calls not getting called. That's people not getting transferred where they need to go. This is a matter of life and death for some people. The Portland Fire Department is down 8. United Ambulance Service in Lewiston right now is down 2 paramedics, 1 advanced EMT, 1 basic EMT. They will be down trucks, which translates again into the difference between a life saved and a life lost. The North Star Ambulance is losing over 14% of their staff. The Barron Center, which houses over 200 plus people in Portland for long-term care placements, which is quite a need in our state, which is suffering. They've already terminated 20 staff members. A nurse in a nursing home, Brick and George, a nurse in a hospital may staff anywhere between 4 and 6 patients in their assignment in a day. Nursing homes can see up to 12 patients in their assignment. So if you're taking out of those 20 staff members, you just think maybe 5 of those are nurses, which I can guarantee they are. 5 nurses can translate into 60 plus people not being able to be seen, needing to find another place, maybe outside of the state, away from their family members. Moving on to hospitals, let's talk about some of the bigger ones first, as that has quite the impact. Not saying rural does not, because the little communities can suffer greatly. So Maine Medical Center has been on diversion for almost 2 days now with no beds. One of their post-op units, which is where they send their joint replacement patients, knees, hips, has been closed due to inadequate staffing for several weeks. Their patients are sleeping in recovery rooms overnight, and they had to travel hire a travel nurse, just to staff their nighttime shift. Most of their elective surgeries are being canceled or have been canceled. They had a capacity of 636 patients, and at the worst, they have seen 45 patients that are designated as COVID patients. So I want to do the math for you. 45 of the 636 inpatient beds that they hold at that hospital, that means that the worst they've seen it in January, only 7% of their beds were used for COVID patients. As of Monday, only 4% of those beds. So what we're doing is Governor Mills has set this mandate and given the premise to people, you know, COVID's bad. COVID's bad just like a lot of other things we see as nurses and that we deal with at the bedside. But it is not, this mandate is not warranted given the numbers of COVID patients compared to other things. And COVID, by the way, in Maine, I'm sure you guys have quite a bit of details yourself, but it's the, it was the eighth leading cause of death. It's not number one, number two, number three. There's a lot of other things we need to be focused on, and we're primarily just focusing on COVID. 12% of beds, by the way, when you compare it to 4 and 7% at Maine Med, 12% of those beds are taken up consistently. This is consistently for patients needing a nursing home, while nursing homes are being shut down around us for staffing issues. Again, interrupt at any time. I've only done one hospital out of the 15 I have. Eastern Maine, people are calling out when they're sick, but people are now calling out and admitting they're calling out because they're plain old exhausted and not wanting to come in due to the burnout. Two travelers were just fired this week for poor performance. So not only are they paying them four times the salary of us nurses who have been loyal to them over the years, they're hiring travelers at a rate of $140 to $160 an hour. The average nurse with over 5 to 6 years experience is only getting in the 30s, the low 30s at that. They're paying $140 to $160 an hour right now for these people to come in, and then they turn around and having to fire quite a bit of them for poor performance. So that's not good either. Maine General, that encompasses mostly where my data came from, and that one is the Augusta campus. But I have nurses from multiple units writing into me. It's standing room only in the waiting room. 445 job openings currently, and they're expecting it to rise over 700 once the mandate takes effect on the 29th. Patients are in the halls or waiting area for hours. People coming in with tragic events are not getting services such as case management and chaplain services. Record number of call-outs. A lot of the vaccinated staff have been the ones that have been calling out with symptoms and being sick, some coming to work and being told to come to work even though they're symptomatic with the virus. The only ones in two of the units who haven't missed work are the unvaccinated. And I'm going to keep moving on because you seem to be okay with it.
Jessica, I want to jump in and ask something because you've done an excellent job of sharing with us a contrasting perception. When we hear statistics like that from the Department of Health and Human Services saying that 80% of Maine school staff and teachers have taken the COVID-19 shot, and then yesterday the Department of Public Safety, and George referred to this earlier this morning, saying that 96.9% of emergency medical services licensees are complying, it's those that aren't complying which actually add up to some hard numbers and create the situation that you're sharing. But let us ask you this. If the governor did allow testing to prove that healthcare workers are negative for COVID-19 and come back in and do their jobs, would it alleviate these problems?
Oh, significantly. Significantly. There are some staff who have already moved on. I myself have already accepted another position. Many have left. Some, I say many, I don't want to use the word many. There are several from each of these facilities who have just left healthcare altogether. They're calling it sick care. They said, I'm done after seeing all this we've went through. They're burnout. They're devastated from what just happened. They feel betrayed. They have left the complete healthcare system. Some, I have a great friend who's opened her own business up. She's a, you know, private provider. She left a facility that she brought in quite a bit of money for them. So it's not just losing staff. They're losing money in doing this. They're actually losing quite a bit of money. She worked in neurology, so that's a pretty big area for money to be coming into a rural area. So you will certainly see many come back, and you certainly will see much of this, what's going on right now, this devastating crisis, will certainly turn around. But she's got to act quickly. There's a lot of people. They have 8 days. Some of these people have till the 29th. Some of us were fired on the 30th of September. There is definitely still hope. There's definitely still hope. So we ask for prayers. We ask for you guys to advocate, for everybody listening to advocate. This is not good. I don't know if you heard recently about, as of October 25th, there will be no emergency care at Wells, Maine location. That was announced, the Wells Emergency Care Service update. Wells, Maine has a population in 2021 listed as 10,933 people. Tell me where 10,933 people, they have to drive at a minimum about roughly 18 miles 18 minutes, it's about 12 miles, 18-minute drive for emergency services. Even if they call 911 and get an ambulance, if they have the staff to do that with the shortages, that's quite a drive. You have, because that ambulance has to get to you and then pick you up and you know, bring you back to that facility. And who's to say they can even see you right away? Because they're already dealing with the York population. They've been asked to divert to the York population for their emergency services. So, you know, you got to think of all those little things add up. All these things are putting quite a burden on our state.
Well, let me ask you the question. Is the fact that the nurses and staff members are not taking the vaccine causing the problem, or were you already short-staffed?
Okay, so some of these facilities certainly had short staffing, but most of this, no, most of this that's going on today is because of this mandate. I can tell you right now from just the hospital that I left, we were doing okay. We had some you know, positions up that were posted for quite a while. Not people weren't filling. We weren't getting travelers, but we were not dealing with this kind of level of people walking out the door. This is, and they didn't, let me go back. They didn't walk out the door. They were asked to leave. They were told to leave. I had a job that I loved, a dream job. I had worked myself up the ladder, got my master's degree, built a mentor program for the hospital, which is one of few in the state. I was a manager, supervisor. I love my job. I mentor quite a few people. I've had quite a few text messages coming in from people throughout the hospital from all different departments telling me what was done was wrong. They miss me. You know, I've left quite a legacy there. And that's great and everything. The problem is when I took that job that I told everybody was my dream job in 2019, pre-COVID, when I looked at my badge and I would show people my joy of that job, I said without a doubt, George, I will be here until I retire. You know, I would have never left that hospital. At the same time, things are meant to be, and where I'm going, it's all meant to be. It's fine. I have peace in all of it. But it certainly was quite devastating. I went through my grieving process. Actually, I was probably completed with my grieving process about a week before it actually came to fruition, and I'm grateful for that. But there's a lot of people that are suffering for this, and a lot of people that are bitter and angry. And, you know, even if we turn this around today, we will lose some of those people because of what they've went through. This is pretty tough.
Jessica, according to the Department of Health and Human Services and their dashboard, which was last updated, I checked it late last night, last updated on the 13th, it said there were 5,700 healthcare workers yet to, their word, comply. If they don't, and we go beyond October 29th, how long, in your opinion, you've got a lot of facts to share, you've got a lot of insight. Jessica, how long after the 29th can the healthcare facilities in our state maintain operations at the workforce loss that they are going to suffer that you've described, that you've illustrated to us? How long can they continue?
Rick, I can't speculate at all, but I'll tell you right now, lives will be lost. I don't know. I don't want to share some details of things I know because I still, believe it or not, love the facility I left, and I really respect a lot of people behind those walls. But I'll tell you, some of the things I've been hearing, they've reached towns away from the hospital, have just got out loose to me the other day of how quickly they're discharging some of the people. People are going to die. People are going to die. That's what I'm concerned about, because if this is truly about public health, this is not the answer. It truly is not the answer. I'm begging for a change in this policy. You know, there's alternatives, there's other things. And like I said, again, I don't know how long they're going to last, Rick. I'm very, very concerned for our state. I really, truly am. And the nation is watching our state. We are leading this country right now with what we choose to do with this. This is not good for our people. This is not good for you, George, your family members. And this isn't just if you're sick. This is when you're going to have someone in your family is going to have a baby. This could be a trauma that's unexpected. This is not good. And I don't know how long they'll stay open. I do believe facilities will continue to close. I believe those who are, based on my personal relationship with people, over 2,500 people in the coalition that know a lot of information inside these walls, but also from the great relationships I'm maintaining in my own facility, former facility, I can tell you that those who are left behind are burnt out beyond measure. They're also calling out for mental health days. They're thinking of leaving, traveling to other states just to get out of here. They said, you know, if I'm going to make this kind of money here, working this hard, I'm going to go somewhere else where this isn't going on and make triple, you know, quadruple my salary. They're getting, you know, bribed, of course, with, you know, double time, bonus money for picking up shifts. People are working 5 to 10 shifts in a row. They're going to get burnt out. Money only lasts so long, you know. We were told, you know, that mills might take away their license if they don't comply. You know, their reimbursement rate from CMS is going to be much better if we're all vaccinated. they got to think long term. This is that money is going to dry up, and what's going to matter is the public health, our safety as a population in Maine.
Mm-hmm. GHRT Rewinds, brought to you by your.
For 8 years under Barack Obama, the Department of Justice was politicized and weaponized. When you came before this committee in your confirmation hearing, you promised things would be different. I asked you specifically, quote, will you commit to this committee that under your leadership, the Department of Justice will not target the political opponents of this administration? Here was your answer, quote, absolutely. It's totally inappropriate for the department to target any individual because of their politics or their position in a campaign. That was your promise just a few months ago. I'm sorry to say you have broken that promise. There is a difference between law and politics. And General Garland, you know the difference between law and politics. Law is based on facts. It is impartial. It is not used as a tool of political retribution. This memo was not law. This memo was politics. On Wednesday, September 29th, the National School Board Association wrote a letter to the president asking the president to use the Department of Justice to target parents that were upset at critical race theory, that were upset at mask mandates in schools, to target them as domestic terrorists. On the face of the letter was in repeated consultation with the White House, in explicit political consultation with the White House. That was on Wednesday, September 29th. 5 days later, on Monday, so right after the weekend, boom, you pop out a memo giving them exactly what they want.
Now, by the way, I understand that. In politics, that happens all the time. An important special interest wants something. Sir, yes, sir. We're going to listen to him. Let me ask you something, General Garland. In the letter, which you told the House of Representatives was the basis for this abusive memo targeting parents, how many incidents are cited in that memo?
I have to look back through the memo. I can't count it.
You don't know. How many of them were violent?
Again, the general report.
How many of them were violent? Do you know?
I don't know.
You don't know. And there's a reason you don't know. Because you didn't care, and nobody in your office cared to find out. I did a quick count just sitting here. During this hearing, I counted 20 incidents cited. Of the 20, 15 on their face are nonviolent. They involve things like insults. They involve a Nazi salute. That's one of the examples. My God, a parent did a Nazi salute at a school board because he thought the policies were oppressive. General Garland, is doing a Nazi salute at an elected official, is that protected by the First Amendment?
Yes, it is.
Okay, 15 of the 20 on the face of it are not violent. They're not threats of violence. They're parents who are unhappy. Yet, miraculously, when you write a memo, the opening line of your memo, in recent months, there has been a disturbing spike in harassment, intimidation, and threats of violence. You know what? You didn't look, and nobody on your staff looked. Did you even look up the 20 instances?
As I testified, the decision to make send a memo is for an assessment.
Did you look up the 20 instances?
I did not read.
Did anyone on your staff look them up?
I don't know the answer, but it's not.
But of course
memo.
You don't. In general, there's a reason. Look, you started your career as a law clerk to Justice Brennan. You've had many law clerks during the year, during your time as a judge. I was a clerk to Chief Justice Rehnquist. I'll tell you what, if I drafted an opinion for the Chief Justice and walked in and it said, there's a disturbing pattern of violence. Well, Ted, how do you know that? Well, I got an amicus brief here who claims it. You would fire a law clerk who did that. You're the Attorney General of the United States. This was not a tweet you sent. This is a memo to the Federal Bureau of Investigations saying, go investigate parents as domestic terrorists.
That is not what the memo says at all.
Is it what the letter says?
I don't care what the letter says.
You don't care. You said it was the basis of your memo. You testified under oath before the House of Representatives. The letter was the basis of your memo. Now you don't care about the letter?
The letter and public reports of violence and threats of violence. My memo says nothing about domestic terrorism, says nothing about parents committing any such things. My memo is an attempt to get an assessment of whether there is a problem out there that the federal government needs to
respond. The letter on its face says the actions of the parents could be the equivalent to a form of domestic terrorism.
And that is wrong.
And asks the president to use the Patriot Act in regards to domestic terrorism directed at parents.
And you'll
this was the basis of your memo.
My memo.
The Department of Justice, when you're directing the FBI to engage in law enforcement, you're not behaving as a political operative because a political ally of the president says, hey, go attack these parents because we don't like what they're saying. Department of Justice, you did no independent research on what was happening, did you?
The memo has nothing to do with partisan...
Did you do independent research?
The memo has...
Did you do independent research?
The memo has nothing to do with...
Okay, you're not answering that
politics.
Question. You've testified you know nothing about the violent sexual assault that happened in Loudoun County, even though it's one of the bases in this letter.
I read about it since then.
Okay. You told the House last week you knew nothing about it.
Not know at the time, no.
Okay. This week, the court concluded that a 14-year-old girl was violently raped by a boy wearing a skirt in the girls' restroom. The school district covered it up, released the boy, sent him to another school where he violently raped another girl. The father, who Mr. Hawley just showed you, was the father of the first girl. He was understandably... Do you understand why a parent would be upset when your daughter is raped at school, the school board covers it up, and then lies to you and claims there have been no assaults, we have no instances? of assaults in our bathroom, and that was a flat-out lie, as the court concluded this week. Do you understand why the parent would be upset?
Absolutely, and is any expressions of upset are completely protected by the First Amendment.
Except you just called him a domestic terrorist.
I never called him that. That's not correct.
This letter calls him a domestic terrorist. You based a direction to the FBI, an official direction from the Attorney General, on this letter, and I'll tell you what, the NSBA is so embarrassed of this letter, they've apologized for it and retracted it. But you don't apparently have the same willingness to apologize and retract what you did. Let me ask you something else. A big part of this letter is that they're upset about parents not wanting critical race theory taught. Your son-in-law makes a very substantial sum of money from a company involved in the teaching of critical race theory. Did you seek and receive a decision from an ethics advisor at the Department of Justice before you carried out an action that would have a predictable financial benefit to your son-in-law?
This memorandum is aimed at violence and threats of violence.
I just asked a question. Did you seek an ethics opinion?
It has no predictable effect.
Did you seek an ethics opinion?
It has no predictable.
Did you seek an ethics opinion? Judge, you know how to ask questions and answer them. Did you seek an ethics opinion?
You asked me whether I sought an ethics opinion about something that would have a predictable effect on something. This has no predictable effect in the way that you're talking about.
So if critical race theory is taught in more schools, does your son-in-law make more money?
This memo has nothing.
If critical race theory is taught in more schools, does your son-in-law make more money? Yes or no?
This memorandum has nothing to do with critical race theory.
Will you answer if you sought an ethics
kind
opinion?
Of curriculum?
Will you answer if you sought an ethics
I am answering the best I can.
Yes or no? Did you seek an ethics opinion?
This memorandum has
did
nothing.
Did you seek an ethics opinion?
This memorandum has nothing to do with
General, are you refusing theory. To answer if you sought an ethics opinion?
I'm telling you that there's no possible
So you're saying no. Just answer it directly. You know how to answer a question directly. Did you seek an ethics opinion.
I'm telling you that if I thought there was any reason to believe there was a conflict of interest, I would do that. But I cannot.
Why do you refuse to answer the question? Why won't you just say no?
I'm sorry.
You're not going to answer the question?
I'm sorry. Ask the question again.
Did you seek an ethics opinion?
I'm saying again, I would seek an ethics opinion.
So no is the answer, correct?
There was a conflict.
Senator, your time is up.
Let the record reflect the Attorney General refuses to answer whether he sought an ethics opinion, and apparently ethics are not a terribly high priority in the Biden Justice Department.
I don't think that's a fair reflection of what I said.
Then answer the question.
Senator, you've gone way beyond any other senator's time. I think you ought to be at least respectful of other senators at this point.
Mr. Chairman, do you know the answer whether he sought an ethics opinion?
I think you have exchanged that so many times, we know where we stand.